If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
You've been listening to Oklahoma Stomp from Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey and their newish album, Winterwood. Winterwood, out now on Royal Potato Records and available wherever you stream music, is one of the latest releases from Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey. What's interesting, though, is this album was buried and not even thought of since, well, 2008. It's an interesting story how this album and an additional four live albums have come to life. In fact, one could argue that if it weren't for the global pandemic of the past year and a half, they may not have seen the light of day. I caught up with Reed Mathis, JFJO's original bassist, to talk about these latest releases, his tenure in the band, and, well, a whole lot more. The conversation started when I asked Reed to remind us about the history of the band, who blended all kinds of genres and styles to make the very original music they started in the late 90s.
The original lineup was eight people. Six of them were going to the University of Tulsa at the time, studying music. And I was in high school. And apparently there were no, like, bass players at that college that were worth a shit. Or at least not that these guys knew. So one of them was asking around at the college, like, or complaining about their lack of bass players. And one of the guys was like, oh, there's this kid that lives down the street from my parents. You should call him. So I got a call from Brian in the middle of the night. I was like a junior in high school, I guess. And I had never been in a band. I'd been playing bass for 5 years, and I was super into a lot of music. I'd never been on stage except for like classical shit, you know, with my parents mostly. So it was intense, man. Brian called me up, picked me up in his truck. You know, I had to sneak out because it was a school night and it was like 1 a.m. We went to a practice room and me and Haas just jammed for hours. And then it was like, let's do this, you know? And then the band was actually called Pimp Cocktail at first.
Oh, wow.
And it was like a party band, you know? It was like, we did like Prince and like, you know, lots of hip hop, like Beastie Boys, James Brown shit, Maceo Parker, you know, it was like overtly a funk band. And then, but the thing is, Haas and I didn't really fit that mold. The rest of the guys were pretty, I mean, everybody was real creative, but the rest of the guys were probably would have been content to be a good funk band. But Haas and I were like mutant people, misfits. And our original drummer, Sean, who passed away, unfortunately. We were looking for more of a, I don't know, shamanic experience. You know, just like sort of an ego death, like sort of a truth serum oriented thing where it's like, let's burn away everything artificial, everything arbitrary. You know, I mean, there's, the surface stuff is all visible, you know, what you look like, how you dress, what instrument you play, you know, so let's burn away that shit. And then the next layer is like genre stuff, you know, what kind of musician are you? What kind of music is this? What kind of audience are you looking for? Like, burn that shit away, you know, because that's arbitrary shit, you know, like genres are as real as state lines. You know, when you cross from Kansas into Missouri, how do you know you just crossed into Kansas and Missouri? Unless something artificial tells you, something man-made, you didn't just go from one. I mean, you just walked across a field. You're not suddenly in a different place. But we all pretend that these divisions are there, and that Missouri and Kansas are different places. You know, rivals even. You know. And it's like, that's how genres are. They're just as arbitrary. There's no actual difference. It's for marketing.
Yeah, it's just a way to put you in a rack at a record store. That's the only reason they exist, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, our culture is, our tolerance for nuance is getting smaller and smaller and smaller to where now we just want the short, just give me the short version. Give me the Instagram version. Give me the meme version. You know, like, who are you guys? Who are you, you know, like, and it's like, well, what if the answer is longer than five words, man? So anyway, we were looking for something a little more apocalyptic, you know, like post this, You know, like, what's next? We want to know what's next, you know?
And is that why the band went from 8 to 3? Because you guys, was it a matter of circumstance, or was it because...
We started touring pretty heavy in the late 90s. And for a minute there, it was really clear cut. This half of the band and that half of the band. It was almost like who tucks their shirt in and who doesn't, you know? Like half of the band was like... reading the Tao Te Ching every day, experimenting with psychedelics, experimenting with nutrition and cleanliness on various levels. And we looked really bohemian, and we were the ones who were interested in like non-genre based improvisation. And then there were the other half of the band, which played pretty straight and looked pretty straight. And those are the guys that went home. but really, I mean, the catalyst for the lineup change was our drummer committing suicide. He was the eldest, and he was the one we all looked up to and the one we all wanted to impress. And he was our best player, you know. It was a mess. And when he passed, it was sort of like, I mean, it forced us all to really like be like, what are we doing? Like, why are we doing this? You know, like, let's see, I was like 23. The other guys were probably 25 when Sean died, 26. So it was sort of like crossroads. Like, are we gonna have wives and kids and buy houses? Or are we gonna keep chasing John Coltrane through the cosmos, you know? And half chose to keep chasing Coltrane, you know? So that's basically what happened. It took, from Sean's suicide to us being a trio, took about a year. It was slightly gradual.
And it was Matt Edwards that stepped into the kit, right? When Sean passed?
Yep. He was our percussionist for the first 6 years. And then when Sean died, it was like, well, Matt already knows the tunes. So Matt got on kit, even though he hadn't played drum kit before, really. But he was a great percussionist, you know? So, and he'd been setting up 2 feet from Sean for 6 years. So he knew, you know, he'd had a master mentor basically. So yeah, Edwards got on the kit and tore shit up for like a year and a half, and then got married and was like, guys, I gotta stay home. I gotta figure out something else. I wanna have this marriage, and I wanna have babies, and I wanna not live in a van, you know? And so Matt left, and by then we were starting to play at like hippie events, you know, and getting exposed to a completely different audience that had a very different, that was more in line with who Brian and I were, you know.
Like opening for MMW or doing festivals.
Well, opening for MMW started at the very beginning. That was gig outside of Oklahoma, was opening for MMW in 95.
Wow, that's great.
I mean, that's what got us going, you know. But at this point, we're talking like 2001. So it was like The Slip, Soundtribe Sector 9 was blowing up.
Oh, Galactic too, right? Galactic is in there somewhere too, right?
Yep. Galactic was our first show in New York was in 96 with Galactic. And it was their first show in New York. And I remember loading in to that gig because it was also my birthday. It was my 20th birthday, right? Yeah. It was my 20th birthday. So I remember loading in and being like the Galactic guys we were all like a little, we couldn't figure out if we were supposed to be competitive or not with each other. And then somebody, I'm pretty sure it was Mercurio, their bass player, kind of stepped across the fence and was sort of like, so what's up? Who are you guys? What are we doing? You know? And like, then he got out, they had their new album. We had our new album. We just traded CDs, and it was sort of like, oh, these guys are just like us. They're the New Orleans version of us, you know?
Right. Totally,
And so we were like, and back then they had like 7 people. We had 7 people at that point. So, you know, felt really aligned. They had just changed their name from Galactic Prophylactic to Galactic. And we had changed our name from Pimp Cocktail to Jacob Red Jazz Odyssey. So we had both dropped a slightly juvenile version of our band name recently.
Yeah.
There was a lot of parallels. You know?
Now it was time to get serious, right?
Right. It was like, maybe we can actually do this, not just for fun, you know? So yeah, you know, there was just, it was like, we were doing that at the exact same time as a ton of other bands, I think. It was like this late 90s, early 2000s. You could still conceivably get in a van and without a record deal, join this culture that was loosely Grateful Dead started, you know? And
yeah, I mean, that's the like Coltrane, and Coltrane influenced Jerry, and that's where the whole kind of inspiration comes from, this idea of not playing hits but playing whatever feels good for an audience who wants to be
playing like for spiritual purposes rather right. than popularity purposes, like
right
making your choices based on
what's real, probably
what it to you spiritually, and not how it will be received, basically. You know, which is a huge fucking gamble. And every manager I've ever had has been like, so you guys, I love what you're doing musically, can we put you in matching suits or something, you know? And it's just sort of like, well, that kind of goes against the premise, you know, like of what we're doing. Or like, you know, like let's do a whole album of Disney songs, you know? It's like, well, that kind of goes against our premise, you know, like the whole premise was like, all drop all artifice, remove all, eat, like even if something you created, like say last night at the show, I improvised something and it fucking worked, and the guys in the band were like stoked and the audience went ballistic, and it's like, oh shit, that really worked. Well, if you do it again the next night, it's dead. If you, Garcia says something cool in an interview at one point about like, we figured out how to make people dance, and then we realized we had to stop doing that because not stop making people dance, but we couldn't do what we knew would work, because as soon as you do what you know will work, you're no longer present. You're no longer vulnerable. You're no longer taking a risk. You're like, if you choose the safe road, you're not improvising. Even if the safe road is copying what you yourself played yesterday, it's still not improvising anymore. If you, you know, so like, so it was just sort of like maximize risk in order to achieve and maintain a level of honesty. I mean, what you're gambling is that level of honesty has a payoff. You know, it's not just like, we want to be hardcore. I mean, there was a little bit of that because young men want to be hardcore. But it was just sort of like, we're going to let go of all these things that have a quick payoff. And hopefully in exchange, we will get the larger payoff, which is this experience of integrity and exploring. Like, you know, the planet's explored. There's not any continents out there left to find. The new frontier is spiritual, you know? And it was just sort of like, well, let's be explorers. Let's find that edge internally of safety versus bravery.
The story goes, in 2008, I believe, you left the band.
Mm-hmm.
Did you leave? You left, right? On your own?
I left.
Was there a specific yeah. reason? What was it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, things always seem different in hindsight, you know? And at the time, we're all doing, in the present moment, we're all doing whatever we can, you know? Things, you never know how things are gonna turn out when you make big choices. But at that time, I had just gotten married, and I was married to a woman who had a chronic life-threatening illness. And we lived in Oklahoma, and this is, you know, pre-Obamacare. So her health insurance cost like more than double what our rent was. It was a serious concern. And Jacob Fred basically made no money.
Right.
You know, the whole reason we were able to stay together that long is because Brian and I were willing to live on like $6,000 a year.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? Like I didn't have an address before I moved in with my wife, you know? We were just on the road all the time. When we were in Tulsa, I stayed on people's sofas, mm-hmm. you know, and I slept in the van, even as if we were still on tour. I would sleep in the van parked in front of Brian's house.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So it was like a way of life that was really intense and really demanding and completely worth it because of the quality of the art we were making. Totally. And the connections we were making with audiences and with friends, you know? And just that feeling of knowing how good what you're making is, you know, like that, it was completely worth it. There was no part of me that was like, should I be doing this? It was like, no, 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 of course, this is obviously I should be doing this, but the price is extreme poverty, you know, which is okay if you're 24, you know, whatever. After I got married, I became friends with Steve Kimmock and he started hiring me and I started actually getting paid like an adult wage, you know?
Right.
And I was like, oh shit, you know, this is different. And then Marco and Russo had been playing together for years. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of had a little falling out. And Marco had all this music that Joe didn't want to play, basically. And so I was staying with Marco. I always stayed with Marco when I was in New York back then. And he was playing me these demos. And I was like, I'll play this shit with you, dude, you know? And we booked a gig with Matt Chamberlain on drums. And that went well. And then we booked a tour. And then we made a record. And then the Marco Benevento Trio was born. So me and Marco and Matt Chamberlain are playing. And that started making some money. And then Tea Leaf Green,
right,
who I didn't know from Adam, I'd never seen them, called me up. Josh Clark called me up and was like, yo, our bass player just quit and we're kind of up a creek. We have gigs that we don't want to cancel. We have a tour that we don't want to cancel next month and we can pay you X. Can you help us out? And I was like, I can help you out temporarily. And I agreed. I signed on to do like a few months. And basically between all these things, I was able to pay for my wife's healthcare.
Awesome.
Which was huge because her family was not helping. And she couldn't work. And so it was on me to keep the household going, basically. So I started getting other work that actually paid me, and which Brian was all for until the scheduling started getting insane. So in 2008, I was a full-time member of Tea Leaf Green, a full-time member of Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey, and a full-time member of the Marco Benevento Trio, and doing Steve Kimmock Band and Everyone Orchestra. So between those five projects, my scheduling was getting absurd and everybody was getting irritated with me. All those camps, nobody was getting their way, you know? And it was like, okay, I got to reduce this. And it was heartbreaking, you know, because the only one of those bands that I was an artist in was Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey.
Right.
And all those other bands, I was a utility guy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Marco Trio wasn't playing my songs. It literally said Marco Benevento on the marquee, you know? And like Tea Leaf Green had already been playing over 10 years. Like they had this massive body of work. They weren't opposed to me writing songs, but their thing was kind of already up and running. And I was just sort of plugged into it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and obviously Kimmock had a career, you know, dated back to like when I was born, you know? So you know, by the time I even took up the bass, Kimmock's career was going, you know? So even though we did play a couple of my originals in the Steve Kimmock Band, it's not like that was going to be a reed vehicle, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like, I had to choose between making a living and
providing,
and,
you know, serious, you know, situation.
Yeah. Like, and so I really didn't want to leave Jacob Fred, and Brian and I talked about it for a few months and he wouldn't budge. I was sort of like, well, how about part of the year we do Jacob Fred, and the other part of the year I go do other stuff that pays me. And during that part of the year, you do Brian Haas and Friends or the Brian Haas Trio or something, you know? And then we do Jacob Fred like half the year. And he was like, nope, you're in or you're out, dude.
Wow.
And I was like, man, How about just like when I'm not there, you call it the Brian Haas Band. And when I'm there, you call it Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey. And then we can do this for the rest of our lives.
Right.
And he was like, he decided to take a stand and like die on that hill, as it were, you know? And he, so he was just like, you're in or you're out. You can't, I'm not going to work around your schedule anymore.
Was that hard? Was it hard to?
It broke my heart.
Yeah.
It broke my heart, you know? But it wasn't all him. I mean, Tea Leaf Green around the same time was sort of like, we want a gig full time. We can't work around Jacob Fred. We can't work around Marco Trio, you know? Marco was the only one who was like, don't worry about me. Right. Do what you need to do. Like, you know, and that's when Dave Drywitz started filling in for me.
Oh, wow.
And then eventually took over when I couldn't do it at all. But for a few years, it was me when I could do it and Drywitz when I couldn't be there. And basically, just through the way events played out, Tea Leaf Green ended up becoming my focus. And Jacob Fred ended up ending for me. They kept going, you know, but after I left, Brian was the only founding member.
Yeah.
And, you know, they made some great shit after I left, you know, and I mean, Josh Raymer is one of the greatest drummers in the world. I mean, you could play Mary Had a Little Lamb with Josh Raymer and it would be ridiculous, you know, and Brian Haas is an undisputed genius, you know, and Chris Combs is somebody I had known for a long time in the Tulsa music community. And so when he's a guitarist, but he basically replaced me
right
in the band because I was as much soloist as I was bassist, and I was more songwriter than it either in Jacob Fred. So Chris took over the songwriter and alternate soloist role. Yeah.
And so then, let's fast forward now to 2020. You're in this thing, this pandemic, and it sucks, and people aren't getting paid because people aren't touring. I'm reading all about all of the projects that you're playing with online. I kept seeing these things on Facebook. Super stoked about what I just found. Super stoked about what I'm working on.
Yeah.
Oh shit, my computer just blew up or stolen. You know, all of this stuff is happening and everybody's wondering, what is Reed the genius, the mad genius, the mad genius working on? And so the story goes that you go to your storage container and you find a whole bunch of old shit.
Well, yeah, like when I left Jacob Fred, you know, it was like, you know, I had basically like all the shit Jacob Fred owned was split between my garage and Brian's garage. Right. And when I left the band and moved to California, we just packed it up the garage. Like I didn't. And then for several years, the feeling was dark between me and Haas. And I just didn't even think about that shit. I just moved it all to California and put it in a storage unit, you know? So yeah, during the pandemic, it was like, I quit drinking. I quit drinking a week before the pandemic started, or wow, a week before all the cancellations. Coincidentally, it wasn't because of the pandemic. It was just time for me to do that. But then everything canceled. And then I'm like, not only sober for the first time in a long time, but off the road for the first time since I was 18.
Right.
And so it just kind of put me in this position where, plus there was this sort of mortality element, you know, it was like quit drinking, quit smoking cigarettes. And then sort of started to take stock of my physical organism, you know, like this little spacesuit that I've been given that I've been abusing for a long time in order to cope with this insane lifestyle. You know, and I just sort of was like, oh my God, I'm gonna die. Like maybe not for a while, but definitely gonna die, 100%. No question there. And with the pandemic shit and just sort of realizing the toll that alcohol and cigarettes had taken on my nervous system, I was like, I might die today. Like, you know what I mean? Like I probably won't, but I have lost friends to heart attacks younger than I am. And I remember when the Darkstar keyboardist died, Scott, you know, he was 40 and he died on tour in a hotel room from a heart attack, you know, and he was when Jacob Fred used to open for Darkstar Orchestra, he was who I went out and smoked cigarettes with in the parking. Like, he was my dog, you know, and he was the one in Darkstar that I was closest to back then. And they, you know, it's like, I'm at an age where I'm starting to get to that age where it's no longer tragic. If I, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I hear you totally.
You know, where it's like, you know, a lot of my heroes did not make it to this age.
Right.
You know, even people like John Coltrane that cleaned up and got sober had already done enough damage to die at 40.
Right.
So I was never a junkie, you know, but I was over a pack a day cigarette smoker for a long time.
Wow. Wow.
So, you know, I just kind of had this feeling of like kind of accepting mortality and aging and the physical aspect of aging. And basically the first thing that occurred to me was how much music that I'm in possession of, like recordings, if I were to die today, how much, like a bus, what if a bus hit me, you know? And it was like, oh, this awful unforeseen thing, Reed's gone. Like, and they came to like look through my bedroom, right? You know, like they would find a box full of hard drives, but who would go through those hard drives and be like, oh my God, there's albums worth of unreleased Jacob Fred music. Oh my God, there's all this, you know, it's like, I was just like, okay, well, what, as an artist, speaking just as an artist, what absolutely must be public before I split, you know? Not that I'm trying to split, you know, I'm here for the long haul. But just like, if I were to suddenly be yanked out of the picture, like, there's so much story that would be untold. Like, all that Jacob Fred shit, like, we used to do all these improvs to start the show. We would go out every night and just clear our minds and start playing. And sometimes that shit was straight sorcery. Like, where there's no explanation for how musical what happened was. It's not like, oh, that was a hot keyboard solo. It's like, no, no, no. Like a composition just occurred between the three of us that none of us could have written on our own. That is the product of our psyches synchronizing and the drive we just did and the fight we had two nights ago and like all of this energy coming out. You know, it's like those recordings aren't anywhere, you know, like, maybe you could go to archive and accidentally find some of the, you know, but those are probably board tapes, you know, those aren't going to sound great, you know, like, so that, and the Winterwood album, which was, we spent like a year working on, like, that was our baby. That was like summarizing 15 years of work for me and Haas, you know, that thing, like, I mean, you know, and then to have that not get a release, to not get pressed, to not get promoted was just like, fuck, that's like the best thing we ever did. That's the album that took us 15 years to learn how to make, you know? And it's just like, that can't exist only on my hard drive. Like, that's a crime.
I gotta tell you, it's brilliant. Like, it's so good.
Thank you. I'm so glad you like it.
I'm like blown away by it. Like, I can't.
I mean, we when we were making it in 2008, we did most of the tracking in March of 08. And then I spent the next 9 months editing and a couple of overdubs, not a ton of overdubs, but building it basically. It's like a sculpture. It's like a massive sculpture.
Yeah.
And the whole time I would like make some moves and do some editing. And then I would have Brian or Raymer come over to my house, my apartment. And we would together, you know, it was like definitely a team effort making that, putting that record together. And then it was just a crime. It was the best thing I'd ever made, you know? And I just couldn't bear to have it, you know? And for the last, you know, few years, like people often, surprisingly often, people assume I'm a founding member of Tea Leaf Green. All the time people go, oh dude, I saw you guys in like 04 at this place and it was so sick, dude, you were amazing. And I was like, well, it's funny, I wasn't in the band then.
right.
And they'll be like, pretty sure you were. And I'm like, yeah, I definitely was not in the band then. And they'll be like, oh, well, what were you doing then? And I'll be like, I was actually in this band for 15 years called the Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey. And they'll be like, oh, cool, I should check it out. And they'll Google it or they'll go to Spotify. And until a month ago, there was almost nothing from my era of that band available.
Yeah, you doubled the catalog. You doubled the catalog.
Yeah, like, you know, so, and the stuff that was up there from my tenure was far from our best work, you know? There was like some shit. There was an album we made when we had been a trio for literally 2 weeks. We had, you know what I mean? We were barely figuring that. And that's like the only album on Spotify that I was involved after. You know what I mean? Like, it was just like, this is a crime. This is a fucking crime for me.
Yeah.
So I just, it just seemed important to me to have, I was like, if I don't do this, no one's going to do it. Brian's not a computer guy. He's not going to take the time. And he's also kind of like a believer in that sort of Miles Davis, Bob Dylan thing of like, don't look back ever, you know, like Miles Davis would never play the song from 2 years ago ever. If he did, it wouldn't resemble it. It wouldn't sound like it. You know, he's not an archivist, you know, whereas I have this default thing in my brain to like make narratives, you know? So I was just like, I'm the only one that can tell this fucking story.
Did you consult with Brian before you? No.
No, I did. I didn't want him to say no.
Right. Yeah. Better to beg for forgiveness than ask
straight
for permission.
So basically I spent two months in the studio. No, 3 months, July, August, September last year in the studio in Oakland, producing the 8 hours of new music. And then I texted Haas and was like, yo, can we get on the phone? He was like, yep. We got on the phone and I was like, so I went through the archive and I put together, he's like, oh, you put together like a best of or something. I'm like, no, I put together 8 hours of new shit. He's like, what? And I was like, yeah, I mean, you know, we don't have to put it out if you don't want to, you know, I'm not expecting anything. I just wanted it to exist. I kind of needed it to exist as a produced body of work. I don't want it to just be like shitty soundboard recordings on archive.org and YouTube videos from someone's phone. No. That body of work, especially like 05 to 08, when we were like a really good band, you know, it's like that, I need that record, these things to exist in a coherent, user-friendly format, you know? But I was like, I'm not expecting you to put this out. I'm not expecting anything from you. I just need this to exist. And, you know, since you technically own the band, you know, I guess this stuff belongs to you. So here's a link to a Google Drive folder with 8 hours of mastered, mixed and mastered and edit, like finished, you know? And then he was like, oh, wow, sick. We got to put this out. And I was like, okay, well, give me a few more months. I got something else I'm cooking up. And he was like, all right. And then I started work on the video. Once I knew he wasn't going to veto the release, I started work on the video, but I didn't tell him I was making the video. and partially because, you know, I wanted to tell the story. Like I'm sure Brian and I would have very different versions of the whole story, probably. We might even have different facts, you know, I don't know. But I've definitely in the years that Brian and I were like inseparable, there were many times when we both remembered an event very differently. And that was then. That was like when it was an event from 2 days ago, we'd be like, no, that didn't happen. That's not what happened. Or like, you know, so I know Brian would have a very different version of events and I didn't want to debate it, you know? And like, that's why at the beginning of the video, I actually say this is my story of what happened, you know, like I'm not, it's definitely not the story. You know, I mean, for fuck's sake, like, you know, the guys from the original lineup, Matt Leland, Dove McCarr, Kyle Wright, Sean Layton, is Sean's family now that Sean's gone, you know, Matt Edwards, even Rod Mackey, who was only there for a year and a half. I guarantee all those guys consider Jacob Fred a huge part of their life and those being formative years. And they're probably really proud of the four albums we made with that lineup. But I breeze past them in the video. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. It went by fast. Like, yeah.
It's, you know, because the new releases are basically like 2005 and on. So I was just basically like, how quickly can I get the listener up to 2005? You know? Because my thing with the video is I don't want anybody to turn it off. I want people to make it to the part where I'm talking about Winterwood, which is the last chapter. So basically, like, everything up to that point, I was like, just go faster. The script, I had the script, you know, and I kept rewriting it to be like, okay, right now it's 800 words. I'm going to rewrite it, go for 600 words. Let's see if I can do it. And then I would do it and it was brutal. And then I'd be like, all right, let's do 500 words. And I just kept forcing myself to shorten it. And, you know, just get faster. So what I'm trying to say is, like, you know, for Matt Leland, the trombone player who wrote basically the entire first album and was a huge driving force for the band in the 90s, he probably watches the video and goes, what is this shit? Like, that's not the Jacob Fred story. It's very specifically.
It's your chapter. Your.
It's the 05 to 08
right.
period. And I just sort of like rushed through the first 10 years to get the listener up to that point. Because the first 10 years to me, I'm really proud of all that music, but I don't know whether those recordings are very user-friendly to people that for whom it's not nostalgic. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I don't
know
how many people would put on the second Jacob Fred album from 1996 and be like, and want to listen to it more than once.
Right.
You know, unless you were there. But the thing is about the 2005 to 2008 recordings, these do hold up to me. These are, you could listen, even if you weren't there at all, you know, even if you were born in 2005, these albums will probably turn you on, you know?
Was there any feedback from guys who were in the earlier era from the video or from hearing this material?
Well, I was too embarrassed to show it to them directly because of how quickly I kind of moved through those years. I was worried that it was disrespectful to their amazing contributions to the legacy of the band. And I just was sort of like, that's another story that should get told at some point. But that's not this story I'm telling here. So basically I sent it to Brian. When I finished the video around Thanksgiving, I sent it to Brian with a link, just like, hey, I made a video to promote the things. Tell me what you think. And he was like, okay, cool. And he didn't respond for a couple of days after that. And then suddenly at like 11 p.m. at night, I start getting these texts. Holy shit, dude. Holy fuck. Dude, what the fuck? You know, like one after the other. And I'm like, oh, he's watching it. He finally put it on. And then, you know, the next day we talked on the phone and he was just like, could not believe it. Could not believe this video, you know? And like, honestly, just seeing us age, me and him specifically, you know, like, cause everybody else was in the band for 4 or 5 years, you know? You see them age a little.
Yeah.
But you really see me and Brian age. I'm 17 at the beginning of the
year. Yeah, you're a little scrawny kid. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm 17 and Brian's 19 when we start the band. So you really see us age and grow. And you just, for Brian and I, it's like, it almost was like a PTSD healing experience, like EMDR or something, where you, you know, where, seeing all those images and seeing them chronological, it's like I see old pictures of Jacob Fred from time to time. People will tag me in a post and they'll be like, here's me and Jacob Fred in 2003, whatever, you know. And I'll see these things and it's like, oh yeah, those were the days, whatever. But seeing it chronological and watching us gradually age, watching people leave the band, seeing all the times that Brian and I had to consciously decide to keep going, you know, and like really use spiritual effort to keep the band alive, and knowing in our hearts that our best music was ahead of us. And we were right. It took us to 2005 to really start making great shit, I feel like. And so it's like seeing all that was, for me and him, I mean, I'm sure for other people seeing it is interesting, but for me and him watching that video was like catharsis.
Yeah.
You know, like tears, you know, of just sort of like the grief, you know, everything we had to sacrifice to live that way, you know, not only financially, but just the relationships that couldn't withstand that lifestyle and our relationship with each other, yeah. which ultimately couldn't withstand that lifestyle. And, you know, the amount of just hope that we had to generate, you know, not only after Sean died, but then when Richard left and when Eddie left and when, you know, and the amount of times that aren't in the video where like, it would be like, hey guys, one of the Sony reps is coming to your gig tonight in New York. So put on a good show. Let's get you guys a record deal.
Yeah.
And then nothing happened. And like the amount of times that happened, you know, the amount of times when we would put a lot of work into making a record or something and then it wouldn't get much attention, you know? And like, and then the deciding to regrow the little leaves and buds every time, you know, like, well, we're going to grow more. Like it was a really, like those albums are the sonic representation of a serious act of faith and hope and will. You know, those aren't just songs. Those aren't just piano parts and bass lines and, you know, shreddy solos and beats. You know, those are actual choices that were made to be stronger than the devil, you know, or whatever, however you want to phrase it. You know, like, it's a heavy thing that we did. It's a very heavy thing that we did. Even if the music we made sucked, it would still be a heavy thing that we did.
Right. Well, it didn't suck. We talked about Winterwood, not in depth. I really think that it's something that people need to hear and feel. And I don't think it's necessary for us to tell people what to think and necessarily hear, except that it's gorgeous, like from top to bottom.
We were, my main memory of making that record, we were just high-fiving, dude. It was like, I don't know, man. We knew what we had on our hands. We knew we had the tunes. For the first time in our career, we had the fucking tunes. These weren't jazz jams or, you know what I'm saying? These were compositions that stand on their own, you know, without us holding them up. And like, pretty catchy, you know, like.
What's so cool about it is I was listening to it, I think the first or second time I was listening to it, and Crazy Fingers came on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, holy shit, are they? They're playing Crazy Fingers, but it sounds like the rest of the record. Like it fits so well into the pattern and the whatever else you've presented.
Right.
That it's to me, all for a second, it wasn't a Grateful Dead tune. It was a Jacob Fred song. Like it was.
Right.
It was incredible. It was like mind blowing for a second.
Wow. That's cool. I mean, you know, the metaphor that makes sense to me with songs and jazz musicians is like, you know, it's like a slideshow, like, you know, physical slides. You and I are old enough to remember physical slides.
Yep.
And so like, you know, the songs are these little slides and we're the light. And then the listener is the screen.
Yeah.
So like, the light and the screen are the same regardless of what slide you put in front of them. It's not like when you put up a slide of the forest, there's a foresty light behind it. And then you put up a slide of a parking lot, and there's a parking lot light behind it. No, it's the same light, you know? And that's like, we were who we were regardless of what song we were playing. That was kind of one of the points that we were trying to make. And especially it's like, you know, if you put all these new releases, including the two that are coming out next month, on into one playlist and hit shuffle, you'll think you're hearing different bands. It's like, there's like acoustic jazz. There's super intense, like broken up Warp Records EDM shit. There's like the pretty Winterwood stuff. There's like dark, like avant Neil Young, Crazy Horse, noise rock. There's like, you know, there's all the stuff. And the thing is, we weren't doing anything different. those are just filters in front of this light that we, that's who we were, you know. It's really fast. It's like, you know, what I keep picturing is that I put out these, all these releases, and, you know, guys like you and me will check it out and it'll be like, oh wow, so cool. But 20 years from now, some kid that's not born yet,
right,
is going to stumble across this body of work and it's going to be like, this is all the same band? Like all of this?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like there's something on display in these 2005 to 2008 years that is very rare, you know, and it's more than the songs. It's more than the playing. It's like,
it's the spirit, right? It's the spirit. And I think as somebody who knows the career and has listened to you guys for a long time, or listened to your work specifically, I get it. I got it right away. So there are, aside from the studio record, there are these four live albums. Spark That Bled is all about the songs and songwriting. Mm-hmm. It's some originals and some covers.
Mm-hmm. But even the originals are very composy.
Yeah, for sure. Nine Improvisations is that stuff that the warm up at a show, yeah, right? All improvs from around the country.
Yep.
Speak No Evil is those acoustic performances, I guess, from the Europe tour in 2006. Is that,
yep,
is that, uh-huh, accurate?
Including the first show of that tour was at the Blue Note in New York.
Oh, wow.
Because we were flying out of JFK. So I included a song from that show too, since that's technically the same tour.
And then the last thing here is this Lil Tate Rides Again.
Yeah. Well, and there's actually a fifth live album that I didn't talk about in the thing that's going to be a surprise.
Okay. Okay. Well, I want to talk about Lil Tay again because,
yeah,
you,
that's
go
like my favorite part of the video.
Well, I don't even know how to explain it. Like, it's electronica. It's loud. It's different. Like, it's different from what preceded it in terms of my listening.
Right.
And it's probably the last time you made a lot of music with these guys. I mean, that's 2008, right? I mean, that's near the end.
2007.
Oh, okay. All right.
Winterwood was the last thing we did.
Okay.
We spent all of 2007 working on Lil Tay Rides Again. And I mean, Tay Mayoakes is somebody I had known since the earliest days. Like, he was in a band, when Jacob Fred started, he was in a band in Oklahoma called Abbey Grange. And then he started a band a few years later called the Tate Quartet that was stupid, that had Sean Layton, our original drummer, on drums. And he and Tay Mayoakes played keys in that band. And him and Brian Haas had been competitors.
For sure.
As, yeah, teenage classical musicians. They were both in, like, you know how, like, when you're in school, there's like competitions. They're like, oh, we're all the classical pianists are going to go compete for judges and get ranked.
Right, right, right.
And several years in a row, it was like Haas number one, Tay Mayoakes number two. And they were like rivals almost. And they're both first named Brian. It was weird. And then in like 1998, they moved in together and started a co-op. And so I lived up the street from them. And they had these raised, in downtown Tulsa, they had raised beds and all this garden and this subscription base of people that came and got groceries every week from them. Huh. And they were organic farmers together, you know? And then he changed his name to Tay Mayoakes and then started making these electronica albums that were just so genius that it was almost hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
It was just a freak, you know, like a freak. And so, yeah, we asked him to produce. And it's funny, we actually went in there and the first thing we did was play most of the Winterwood music at his studio. And he was like, nah, what else you got? And I was like, dude, this is Dove's Army of Love. This is great. No, this is great. And he was like, not feeling it. Cause he's just like dark. He's a dark dude.
Yeah.
And all the Winterwood music was pretty bright, you know? And so what we ended up just doing was kind of jamming and he would record it. And then start cutting and pasting, you know, and like building these things. And so basically, like, he composed that record out of samples that he made of us. And then we learned how to play the shit that he built out of our
stuff. Wow.
You know what I mean? Like when he played us the record, it was like, I didn't recognize any of it. I was like, is that even us? You know?
Really?
And he was like, oh yeah, that's you. That's, see that melody right there. That's your guitar. And then, but he was also turning our instruments into synths. So I would play something on guitar, and when you hear it on the record, it sounds like church bells or something, you know, like he was turning our instruments into MIDI information,
right?
And then making digital instruments out of them. So you might not even hear a bass guitar or an electric guitar or a Rhodes piano, but that's us. It's just, he made other sounds out of them. But then he also put in all these ambient sounds, like his footsteps in a parking garage. And
it's weird.
It's spooky shit. And the whole thing ended up being based around his son at middle school.
Hmm.
You know, his son, that's who Little Tay is. Little Tay is his son, Teo. And Teo basically like having the emotional reality of a middle schooler. You know, I took up the bass in sixth grade. That's about when Brian got into Led Zeppelin and stuff. You know, like we all sort of, our musical identities kind of began in middle school.
Yeah.
And so this dynamic of like bullies and girls and like social hierarchy and physical sports and being sensitive and pretending not to be sensitive and kind of being 1 foot still a child, 1 foot starting to be grown up, and like the polarity of those two things. And like, he just kind of built this sort of concept album that explored all those emotions, you know? And, you know, he said it was about his son, but it's about us. It's about all of us still kind of carrying the damage that happened socially in middle school, you know? So yeah, fucking creative as hell. Like, none of that was our idea. That was all Tame Oaks, you know?
Don't tell us what the surprise is, but I'm psyched to hear it.
More of our awesome conversation with Reed in episode 324, which will drop this Sunday, June 13th. Before we leave you, let's go back to the Blue Note Cafe and this totally improvised set from the album, 9 Improvisations. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.